This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Central Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nick C, a host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Dr. Julia Obertrice, author of Imperial Desert Dreams, Cotton Growing and Irrigation in Central Asia, 1860 to 1991, published in 2017 by VNR Uni Press. Dr. Obertrice holds the chair of Modern and East European History at the University of Erlangen-Nuremberg in Germany. She has published on a variety of topics, including oral history, environmental history, the history of infrastructure, across the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. She also serves as the chair of the Germany-based Association for Historians Working on Eastern Europe. Julia, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Hello. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk about your book today, which I've read recently with great pleasure. And in the book, you're kind of looking at the infrastructure of cotton growing in Central Asia, both in the imperial and Soviet periods. And you're paying specific attention to kind of the infrastructure surrounding water and generally, the state's plans to transform the region. But I want to start with a very basic question and ask how you decided to start studying, to start studying Central Asia in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I have been to Central Asia for the first time in 1992 when I was a student. And this was just after the breakdown of the Soviet Union. And as you can imagine, it was a very interesting period to be there as a visitor. It was a tumultuous period, I would say. And we had lived together with a friend. We had lived in St. Petersburg for several months. And then we started traveling around the former Soviet Union. We went to Ukraine and then we went to Astrakhan. And from there, via train, to Tashkent. And when we got there, we got arrested by the police at the train station because we hadn't cared for visa for Uzbekistan that had been introduced just a few weeks or months before, and we didn't know about it or didn't care about it. So this was a very exciting beginning, and we were at the police station and were interrogated, so to say, but they were quite friendly. And after some time, they released us, but told us that we cannot live in a hotel because we don't have a visa. And so we had to rent some apartment, and that was part of a quite interesting stay in Uzbekistan. We stayed there for 2 or 3 months, weeks, I think. And so this was my first encounter with Central Asia in a very interesting time. And later, after I had finished my PhD thesis, which was on housing in Leningrad in the 20s and 30s, I worked like a kind of freelancer for a while and worked for an institute near Berlin. And they did some work on the history of water. And that was not about Eastern Europe or Soviet Union, but just the history of water in Germany and France and the history of the River Rhine. But I got very interested in these questions of water history, environmental history. And then I was searching for some water project that I could do on Eastern Europe. And a colleague told me to work on the irrigation systems in Central Asia. And as I had been there before, I found that very interesting and just started to work on it. And then it was quite difficult to get the permission to get into the archives in Tashkent. I knew that I have to receive a permission from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I tried to get it through the Uzbek embassy in Berlin. And they invited me for tea. We were sitting there having tea, having some very nice sweets. It was a really nice atmosphere and we were talking about my project. And then they promised to get me the permission and, it took several months. I was waiting and waiting and, but in the end, I got the permission. I could enter the archives in Tashkent.
And what was this when you were first entering the archives in Tashkent?
I've been there in 2007 and 2008.
Okay.
And I think I've been to the Central State Archive in Tashkent and to the Central State Archive of Scientific, Technical and Medical Documentation. And I think I was lucky to be there at that time because at that time it was really easy to work there. And later on it got more difficult. So I could order almost everything I wanted from the funds and, I received it quite quickly. I could photograph, documents. I could do copies and it was all relatively cheap. So I could get a lot of material in a rather short time, and that was really good.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of materials were you working with there? And did you find that, like, the materials you were finding changed the project in any way, or did you go in and actually find the materials that you expected to find in the first place?
No, I really didn't know what to expect, and I didn't have any... archival information, you know, before I went there. So I just got there and started searching. I think for the pre-revolutionary period, I don't have archival material. I have published materials. But for the Soviet, and especially from the 1930s onwards, I have quite a lot of archival material and I think it's a very important part of my sources. And it allowed me to get insights into how the state was dealing with cotton growing and with irrigation and which problems they were aware of and which kind of solutions they thought and so that's really a big part of my source base.
Mm-hmm. And I think it comes through with the kind of arguments that you're trying to make. And specifically, I wanted to kind of ask about your approach. I know that you kind of use this term high modernism, popularized by James Scott, but you seem to be kind of trying to push either the limits of high modernism forward or kind of adjusting his original analysis in your own work. So I was wondering if you could like speak to that. Like, what does the Soviet case tell us about high modernism? What is high modernism? And how might your approach actually allow us to think more comparatively about Soviet history in kind of a global context?
I think high modernism is a good concept to enable comparisons. Comparisons between the Soviet Union and especially Central Asia and the West on the one hand, but also with non-Western contexts and countries on the other hand. What is at the core of high modernism? High modernism is the drive to transform nature and human societies at the same time, according to standardized plans designed at drawing boards. And these plans, these schemes, as Scott calls them, do not take into account local conditions, which is their major flaw. So I'm thinking of, for example, of the size and form of cotton fields, on the setting up of irrigation schemes and sovkhoz farms, and so on. There were plans for model cotton fields, for example, which were, of course, large and rectangular. And there is even a quotation by Khrushchev, who said that a correct square, a pravilny kvadrat, is the basis for the usage of machines. So this was the connection between the form of the fields and the usage of machines, the mechanization drive the Soviets had. As you said, I'm not an uncritical supporter of higher modernism as it is laid out by James Scott. And in the introduction of my book, I criticize it in some detail for not giving information on historical periods where high modernism was strongest. That's very vague in his work. There's also the criticism that high modernism centers too much on the state as a central actor, and some other points. But I tried in my book to historicize this concept of high modernism, so to say, to bring some historical flesh to the bones. But yeah, in the end, I think that this approach might help in enabling comparisons. And it's also a pragmatic reason that made me choose it as a central approach, because this concept is well known, not only in historiography, but also in other disciplines.
And I'm curious, so, I like this approach of trying to historicize like high modernism, and I think this is what allows you to actually look at like very, you know, sometimes very drastic, but sometimes very nuanced changes happening throughout this large period. You know, you're looking at a period from the 1860s all the way up to the collapse of the Soviet Union. I'm wondering, like, broadly, what changes we see in the production of cotton, in the manipulation of water resources, from the late imperial period through the Soviet period. Do we see any kind of continuities between, across the revolutionary divide, maybe in places that we might not have expected them? I know you have this, you spend some time looking at kind of late imperial officials who actually did play a role in imagining what cotton cultivation would look like in the 1920s and 1930s. So I was wondering if you could speak to some of those themes a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think there are really important continuities, and I tried to stress them in my book, because usually you have the research not only on Central Asia, but also on the Soviet or Russia and the Soviet Union in general, is more or less divided into the research done on the imperial period up to the October Revolution and the research on the Soviet period. And I try to, look at both periods and stress the continuities. And one major continuity is the idea of becoming independent of foreign cotton imports, what is called in Russian, it was termed the Chlopkovaya Nisavisimost. And that idea was coming up in the 1880s, 1890s. It was partly a consequence of the American Civil War, because cotton imports from the US dropped down at that period, and several countries were looking for alternative sources of cotton imports. And then it is more and more popularized, and it is used by many authors in the imperial period. And then it is transferred very smoothly into the Soviet period, and the Soviet state also tried very much to become independent of foreign cotton imports. And the second continuity is the idea of cultivating the region, Central Asia, through irrigation and through agriculture, especially cotton growing. And that implies to make it green, which was more familiar to Slavic observers and authors writing about it, to make it more productive, to make it more modern and also more civilized. So this idea of cultivating is very clearly expressed in the imperial period, and then it is also taken up in the Soviet period, although maybe in a little bit different, in a different framing, of course, and also a little bit different wording, I would say. But of course, you also have strong differences. And one of them, very obvious, is that that the conditions of property, owning and owning land and water and so on are changing. In the 20s, the communists had ideas of strengthening the corporations. But then, as we all know, the collectivization of agriculture started. And although it met with much resistance, especially in Central Asia, it was carried through and was enforced. And so the socio-economic setting was changed very much. But another important change is the inclusion of Central Asians. We all know this famous term korenizatsia, the politics of including the non-Russian or minority peoples into all sectors of life and also into leadership positions. And this started in the 20s, of course, and often you can read that in the 30s it was kind of, it ended, and then there was Russian chauvinism, Russian dominance and so on. But in fact, I think that these ideas of inclusion, that they went on in the post-war period as well. And Korenizatsia as a principle, it didn't stop. And to the contrary, the main results of Korenizatsia came into effect in the post-war period, when you had a significant number of students in all spheres, but also the first leadership persons in the spheres of politics, quite a few, and from the 20s on, of course, but also in the spheres of technical expertise, although less than, for example, in education. The first professors and doctora nauk. So I would say that this inclusion of Central Asians, who also became the carriers of these ideas of modernity and progress and growth and so on, is a very important difference between the imperial and the Soviet period.
Yeah, and so based on what you've just said, you know, we see a lot of similarities. I mean, we see a very familiar periodization of Soviet history here. You know, you've talked about the 1920s, you've talked about collectivization, you've talked about kind of a bit like expansion of opportunities to some extent for Central Asians in the immediate post-war period. You know, one benefit, I think, of your book is that you're looking at such a long, you know, you're looking at more than just the Soviet period, but we get the whole span of the Soviet period, you know. And I'm just curious, do you see that the history of cotton production and kind of the manipulation of water resources, does your focus on these aspects of Soviet history still in some ways conform to the typical contours of Soviet history that we see, you know, which largely follow leadership? You know, we talk about the Stalin period, we talk about the changes under Khrushchev, and then kind of I guess they would call it the stagnation under Brezhnev. Do you see these similar, like, I don't know, was there anything surprising that you found in the history of cotton production that maybe challenges this typical periodization, or does it confirm it in a lot of ways?
I think that cotton growing is relatively independent of changes in political leadership. And irrigation is too, in a way, I would say. But also you can see, so I don't see that there are the big watersheds, you know, connected to the changes in leadership. And you have these very, you know, the general trends to receive more and more cotton from Central Asia, this preference for mechanization and what was called chemicalization. So this is the usage of pesticides and herbicides, and also the strong personal ties between the sphere of politics, the state and the party, and the sphere of technical expertise and the actual building and setting up of canals and cotton fields. So all this is connected by personal relations. And this goes through the Soviet period, I would say. And the continuities are more important in the end than some changes. But, and also you can see that you have, you know, strong continuities between late Stalinism and the Khrushchev period. For example, there was a campaign to enlarge cotton fields, the Ukrupnenie it was called, the late 1940s it begins. So it begins in the Stalin period and is then carried on in the Khrushchev time. And all this, you know, this striving to enlarge irrigation systems and to really go to big solutions. This is something that also connects the Khrushchev and the Brezhnev periods. So in general, in Soviet history, we have this trend to underline the continuities, especially between the Khrushchev and the Brezhnev periods, and to develop new perspectives on the Brezhnev period, and then not to see it only as a period of stagnation, but also to see it as a period of change. And also I would like to say that environmental history and infrastructure history allows us to challenge existing political periodizations. But as you said, they are still very strong for Soviet history.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to turn to kind of the question of environmental history and environmental issues in the next question, because, you know, you're looking at Uzbekistan primarily, although you do spend some of the book looking at Turkmenistan as well. And maybe you can talk about what sources you used to look at Turkmenistan. I'm sure our listeners would find that very interesting. But, you know, the kind of elephant in the room is the Aral Sea, which is typically when people who are kind of familiar with Central Asia and familiar with like environmental issues like the drying up of the Aral Sea comes to mind. And this is, of course, directly linked with irrigation schemes and cotton production. But you look at a kind of interesting aspect of this, which is kind of the emergence of an environmental consciousness in the late 1970s and 1980s. And I think this, maybe you were alluding to this, this is one of those moments that we can actually learn something new about Soviet history that challenges those dominant political narratives. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. I know you spend some time in that, looking at that in the book, so I think it would be very interesting to hear about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you mentioned the drying up or the siltation of the Aral Sea. This is the major and very well-known phenomenon. I think almost everybody has heard of it who has something to do with Central Asia or with the Soviet Union. But there were also other serious ecological problems like which stemming from cotton growing and irrigation, which like water logging or the salinization of groundwater and of soils, And we also had a strong water deficit, a shortage of water beginning from the 70s. I have sources on the late 1970s that people were complaining that didn't have enough water, not only for irrigation, but also for drinking. So you have these serious environmental problems, people were, of course, reacting to it. And I think it is one of the strengths of my book that it shows how environmentalism gradually emerges and gets stronger. Although there's no linear development from the 70s to the 80s. And Central Asia is a region that was and is very much affected by man-made changes in the environment. So it's no surprise that people got aware of it and were concerned. But usually when you think of environmentalism in the Soviet Union, you don't necessarily think of Central Asia. But I found that Central Asia fits very well into the general Soviet pattern, that we have a more, so to say, elitist environmentalism. It's not a broad social movement from below or grassroots movement like we have it in the West at that time, but it's more expressed in academic journals, also in the general press. So it's more, you know, the carriers of this environmentalism are more like scholars and writers. But also, of course, we have a state-driven environmentalism. There's quite a lot of good laws, so to say, on environmental protection in the Soviet Union and also in Central Asia. And they tried to get control of all the problems via inspections, for example. But you refer to the perestroika and to periodization questions. I think it's very important to state that environmentalism in Central Asia and also in general in the Soviet Union did not emerge only during the perestroika time, but it emerged much more earlier. There's no consensus on this, whether it's the early 70s or the mid 70s or the late 70s. But in fact, many people do agree that that there is some kind of modern environmentalism emerging in the 70s. And its subjects, you know, get more and more serious. And there are certain structures that are confirmed, certain journals, certain institutions, for most of all the Academy of Sciences, which plays a major role. And when perestroika starts, the conditions for making these problems, for getting them into the public, these conditions change, of course. You have a much broader variety of possibilities to express these problems in the press. There are new formats like roundtables and so on. But the subjects, and also I think in many cases the people who were working on this, they were there before the mid-80s.
Yeah, I think you bring up some interesting points. You know, I'm thinking about how this story in Central Asia might relate to kind of like follows contours that we see elsewhere, especially in Russia and other places within the Soviet Union. I'm thinking of the work of Douglas Weiner and people like Stephen Brain, who have kind of looked at how there is kind of a unique way in which environmentalism emerges in the Soviet Union that, as you said, like does emerge in official institutions. In a way that kind of contrasts what we see in the West, which I find fascinating. But it's interesting to see how this is developing in a Central Asian context. You know, I know from looking at Tajikistan that we see similar criticisms of the hydroelectric station kind of building the creation of dams in Tajikistan, which many people started to see, like not only caused suffering on humans, but also on the environment. And, the contemporary states in Central Asia are in some ways dealing with these legacies in very important ways. And actually, the creation of independent states has exacerbated these problems or kind of created new related problems of kind of dealing with these legacies. So I think it's, not only are you telling a really important story, but I think we can see the ways in which it's still a problem today.
Yeah.
So I think that's another kind of aspect of the book and that I really liked. Could you talk a little bit more about this comparison between environmentalism in the Soviet Union and in the West? Is there room for comparison between those two kind of like movements or consciousness or whatever we want to call it?
Yes, I think there is room for comparison. But what we find is of course, quite strong differences in terms of the structure of these environmentalisms. By the way, this is a very good term, environmentalism in English, as opposed to Umweltbewegung in German. In German, you have environmental movement. But as I said, I don't think you can speak of a movement in the Soviet case. And environmentalism is, as a term, is much broader and can include all kinds of activities and thinking. And this is a good term to use for comparison. In the West, I mean, it was also, of course, state-driven environmentalism. It was not only a movement from below, and from below means mostly students, young people, but also in some cases farmers. For example, when it came to the construction of nuclear power stations in Germany, for example, you had this really broad movement, including local citizens and peasants who didn't want this to be built in their region. But you also have, of course, a state agenda. You have some kind of agencies concerned with environmental problems. And you can very well, I think, compare this to the Soviet case and to other socialist countries as well. And when we look at the socialist countries, we see that, there were laws for environmental protection, the protection of soils, of waters, of the air, and so on. But in many cases, these laws were not followed and they remained on paper. Because they were not really enforced. This is a big problem. And also you have this kind of strong role of the writers, not only journalists who take up these subjects of environmental protection, but also writers in their works. They write about nature, their views on nature, and these views on nature, they are changing very much because from the official side, from the socialist propaganda, so to say, you had this view on nature as nature has to be conquered, very much related to, in the case of Central Asia, to the steppe and the desert, to conquer the steppe, to conquer the desert, to make it obedient to man. And also it's related to water. A river has to flow the way the man wants it to flow, and irrigate water from the river is used for irrigation and it should not, just flow into the Aral Sea and evaporate. So these ideas of socialist official ideas of nature were quite one-sided. In contrast to this, you had other ideas of nature being something sacred, being something to be protected, and so on. Yeah, these are specifics, I would say, of the Soviet case, that there are, these ideas are expressed very much in the spheres of scholarly work and in the sphere of literature and by the writers.
And I just kind of want to take that a little bit further and think about the current moment and kind of since the collapse of the Soviet Union. I know this is a little bit out of the scope of your book, but I was wondering if you could kind of comment like on how this kind of cotton industry and the irrigation systems within Uzbekistan or in Central Asia in a broad way, like how the Soviet period has kind of left its legacy on those industries and those kind of relationships between state and economy. And, aside from the obvious Aral Sea conundrum, I'm just curious if you can speak to that in any particular way.
Mm-hmm. I think that the Soviet legacy is very strong in the cotton sector. The cotton sector is still a very, very important sector in Uzbekistan to this day. There are several major problems which are connected to the political authoritarian rule in Uzbekistan, but also partly to the Soviet legacy. One is that cotton growing is so central for state politics, but also I would say for a national Uzbek identity. And this is what I try to show. I think this is a study, is an aspect that can be studied in more detail in future research by somebody else. I try to show that in the 80s you have this discourse on cotton as a national pride, you know, cotton very much related to what it means to be Uzbek and Soviet Uzbek. Cotton is still the central economic sector, and it's very much state controlled. And there's still much coercion going with that. People are forced to go to the cotton harvests to work on the fields. And you know that there is a problem of child labor as well, which is addressed oftenly, but as far as I know, it hasn't really changed so much. And also, of course, you have a very concrete material legacy of irrigation systems that remain from the Soviet period. That cannot be changed very, very quickly. So in many cases, on the spot, you have the irrigation systems that were built in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and they are still used, of course.
Yeah, thank you for that. And these are kind of things that are important to keep in mind, I think. I've just been kind of reflecting and thinking about how Central Asia is experiencing the pandemic right now, and how actually these questions are really important, you know, to think about kind of monoculture and how people still kind of need to produce cotton in order to keep their livelihoods going, and how the pandemic might be affecting that. So these are just things that I think we need to continue to think through. So I appreciate your answer on that. And I think we're actually nearing the end of our time here, but I wanted to give you a chance, Julia, to talk about maybe future research projects, things that you are thinking through right now. Give you an opportunity to share any plans you might have or ideas that you're thinking about. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. In terms of research on Central Asia, I am currently working on a special issue together with Jonas van der Straten. He's a German, he's a historian as well. He's from the Technical University of Darmstadt in Germany. In April, we had a workshop via Zoom. This was the beginning of the Corona period. And it was my first major event on Zoom. And I was excited. I didn't know if it would really work out, but it was really good. We were talking with colleagues from Central Asia, from different countries, from Russia, from Germany, from France. And yeah, it was really fun. And now we are doing this special issue. It's on technology, temporality, and the study of Central Asia. And it will be a special issue of Central Asian Survey. So it's the history of technology, and it's also about infrastructure. Roads play a major role, for example. But it's connected to the problems or questions of temporality for Central Asia, often being depicted as backward, you know, some a region that has to be brought into modernity and so on. And we will try to reflect on these issues. Also, I have another project, and this is my main research project right now. It's on the history of smoking and non-smoking in the post-war 20th century period. There's a fabulous book by Tricia Starks. It's called Smoking Under the Tsars. It's about the smoking of papirossi in the imperial period. And she's currently working on a book on smoking in the Soviet Union as well. My project is much broader geographically, and it will examine transfers and exchange between Western and Eastern countries. So I intend to include the USA, England, Italy, Germany, East and West, Bulgaria, Poland, and the Soviet Union. And within the Soviet Union, besides Russia and Ukraine, Central Asia will be of special interest, of course. This might sound like a crazy idea, like a megalomaniac idea, but much of this project will be based on existing literature, plus some chosen source materials. And if anybody who will listen to it has any ideas about smoking in Central Asia or has some advice on interesting sources or something, please let me know.
Great. Both of those projects sound really interesting. And, you know, we'll definitely be looking for the special edition there. And the greater research project also sounds fascinating. And hopefully we can have you back on New Books Network once you complete the book project. Well, Julia, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. And just a reminder to our readers, if you're interested in some of the themes we talked about today, check out Julia Obertreis's book, Imperial Desert Dreams, Cotton Growing and Irrigation in Central Asia, 1860 to 1991. Published in 2017 by VNR Uni Press. So thanks again, Julia.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thank you for having me.